Morning, Oregon, and happy Friday. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at offbeatoregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Thanks for joining me, and I hope you enjoy the show today. Welcome back to part two of this two-part presentation of the life and journey of Old Portland's One Woman Rescue Aid Society. It was first published on June 1st, 2023, under the headline, First Policewoman Was a Municipal Rescuer, and that's rescuer as in Disney's The Rescuers. This is the story of Lola Green Baldwin, the first policewoman west of the Rockies, friend to the friendless and, alas, also enthusiastic eugenics promoter. We had just gotten to the part where she was tapped to run the operations of the Portland YWCA to prevent young ladies who were in town for the Centennial Exposition from falling into the clutches of sex industry workers. And by all accounts, she did a phenomenal job of this. Hundreds of volunteers from aid societies, social clubs, and churches patrolled the streets and haunted the Union Station, spotting solitary girls and adopting them as unsolicited chaperones, offering them safe lodging and guiding them on their trips. Along the way, they frustrated numerous attempts to recruit them into dodgy or straight-up immoral situations. They also caught up with a few girls after it was too late and guided them through the process of prosecuting their seducers or forcing them to the altar. Often the forced marriage was followed almost immediately by a divorce accompanied by a court order for child support. But they noticed something interesting along the way. Few of the recruiters they came across were visitors. Nearly all of them were local operators looking for fresh, bourgeois damsels to feed into the front end of the saloon-centered flesh machines here in town. By the end of the fair, Lola Baldwin was convinced that the real problem was not smooth, sinister foreign agents. It was a homegrown problem, which meant that it was not going to go away when the fair ended. It would just go back underground. Local recruiters and pimps would go back to catching a girl here and a woman there on the street or at a lunch counter and luring them into a life of exploitation from which it would be very difficult to escape. If anything, the end of the fair made things worse. Job opportunities for single girls and women became scarce, which raised the specter of girls being forced to accept a dangerous gig in a sleazy saloon to ward off starvation or eviction. At the same time, many of the donors whose support had made the job possible now stopped thinking the job was done. The Travelers Aid Society struggled to meet the challenge. Finally, in 1908, Lola Baldwin got in front of the city council to make a modest proposal. "I beg to submit to you a few facts," she told them, "in regard to the work of the Travelers Aid for the protection of girlhood in Portland." Then she laid out a very lucid overview of what she and her team had been up to for the previous 2.5 years, including some statistics. 230, quote, special girls assisted in 1906, 322 in the first 11 months of 1907, and no end in sight. This, she submitted, was evidence that the Portland Police Department needed a program to safeguard Portland's at-risk girls. She asked for a budget of $3,000 for the job. Finally, she closed her speech with one of the more brilliant rhetorical gambits of Oregon history. "We notice," she said, "that there was $5,030 used this year for the dog pound, and an additional $1,000 is asked for in 1908. Would the council consider," she asked, "allocating half that amount for practical, positive protection for the growing girlhood of the city of Portland?" Well, when one put it that way, how could they have possibly said no? Lola Baldwin started her new job as a police detective in April 1908. It was the beginning of a 15-year career with the Portland Police Department. At the beginning, her primary goal was to prevent girls from falling into the clutches of vice operators rather than punishing them after they did. So she maintained her traveler's aid office at YWCA and dressed in plain business clothes, keeping her star in her purse where it could be deployed only when needed. At-risk girls who needed her help would, she knew, be very reluctant to visit the police station to get it. She was very successful in this. In large part, that was because of her relentless focus on the girls. She made connections with saloon owners and even bordello madams who would actually contact her to come and rescue underaged girls. She was feared by some, loved by many, respected by all. at least at first. In fact, if Lola Baldwin had been run over by a streetcar in 1909, a year after taking on her job, she would be remembered today as an untarnished hero, a Mother Teresa figure, a rescuer, like Bianca from the Disney movie. But this focus shifted fairly quickly and led Detective Baldwin to a darker and less noble place. Although she never lost her focus on providing support for girls at risk of making bad choices, she became increasingly harsh toward those who had already, quote-unquote, fallen. Mostly this was because of one of the more toxic trends in the progressive era thought, the moral authoritarianism of the social hygiene movement. The social hygiene movement, aka the sex hygiene movement, was a movement led largely by mainstream medical doctors, and it was a reaction to new medical evidence of the damage caused by various forms of vice, especially prostitution. At some point just before the turn of the century, doctors confirmed that prostitutes were a disease vector. Young, horny men would patronize them in their 20s, acquire a venereal disease, and pass it on to their innocent future wives. This obviously was a serious public health issue. The solution, according to social hygienists, was to stamp out prostitution entirely for the protection of the innocent. There could be no more consideration, or not much more consideration, for the plight of the poor fallen woman, the unfortunate creature to be pitied rather than judged, as earlier progressives like Baldwin had felt. It took a while for this shift in perception, from prostitute as tragic figure to prostitute as filthy disease vector, to percolate into Lola Baldwin's practice as Portland's first policewoman. But by the early 1910s, it pretty much had. She was still all about saving the innocent girls from a life of shame, as she called it, but when it came to the girls who were already living the dream, as it were, her focus shifted from saving them to saving society from them. So Detective Baldwin vigorously moved against anything that seemed like it might lead to prostitution or even freelance premarital sex. Massage parlors, variety theaters, shooting galleries, even dance halls. In 1911 and 1912 alone, her team raided 216 establishments on vice charges and arrested 1,900 people. She followed up on them afterward, too, advocating for stiffer sentences to break the catch, fine, and release cycle that the city had used for decades to rake off a cut of sex industry profits. The shift in focus from saving girls to saving society from the girls was at its apex during the First World War, when Baldwin received federal police authority and a mandate to enact a sort of moral martial law everywhere on the West Coast within 5 miles of a military base, to keep soldiers safe from venereal disease. After the war, popular opinion rapidly shifted away from Baldwin's style of progressive authoritarianism, and she started having to defend her job. By now, of course, she was in her 60s. The ragtime era had come and gone, ripening into the jazz age. Musical styles that she disdainfully associated with black culture and quote-unquote degeneracy. Flashy clothing styles that she had once associated with prostitutes were now standard fashions for a rising generation of flappers. Things just seemed to be getting worse and worse. So, increasingly discouraged and out of touch with the times, Lola Baldwin retired from police work. Afterward, she remained active in various charities dedicated to keeping girls safe, but her days of supervising the kicking in of bordello doors were over. She finally died at the age of 97 in 1957. The story of Lola Baldwin is somewhat hard to get straight these days. Modern society is far more libertarian than hers was, with far less consensus on what constitutes good culture and what constitutes bad or degenerate culture. Quotes around degenerate there. It's super easy to look back on the Lola Baldwin who behaved like a reactionary authoritarian busybody, shutting down dance halls on the off chance that patrons might have sex with one another, and throwing suspected prostitutes into psychomedical custody for months to keep them away from soldiers, and to forget what an extraordinary and daring thing it was for a woman to do what she had done 14 years before that. It's easy to recoil from the overt racism and snobbery of the AIDS Society movement and overlook its role in battling against real human trafficking. That's why I like Disney's The Rescuer so much. It captures the spirit of an earlier AIDS Society movement before it had been corrupted by the drive to perform social surgery, back when it was all about saving the girls and empowering young women to choose their own destiny, back when women like Lola Green Baldwin were untarnished heroes. Like so many other Progressive-era figures, Lola Baldwin was a trailblazer. She was venturing into spaces that are well known today to us, but which she was seeing for the very first time. It's probably not too surprising that she made some bad calls, and she hurt quite a few people along the way. But one thing nobody can dispute, throughout her life in Portland, Lola Green Baldwin did her level best to leave the world a better place than she found it. And we should all aspire to such an epitaph. Key sources in this story included A Municipal Mother, Portland's Lola Green Baldwin, a book by Gloria E. Myers, published in 1995 by OSU Press, Storied and Scandalous Portland, Oregon, a book by Joe Streckert, published in 2020 by Globe Pequot, Lola G. Baldwin, an episode of Oregon Experience, produced in 2008 by Nadine Gelsing of Oregon Public Broadcasting. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. And by the way, if you haven't yet, check out our Offbeat Oregon books. They're a lot like these columns, only expanded and updated to take advantage of a less restrictive format. We've got Heroes and Rascals of Old Oregon, Love, Sex, and Murder in Old Oregon, Bad Ideas and Horrible People in Old Oregon, and eventually the plan is for 8 of them to be out, although how many there are out right now depends on when you hear this. They're a lot of fun and would look great on your bookshelf. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Check out our hub page at offbeatoregon.com to explore all the other things we do or to find the full citations and visuals that go with today's show. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Offbeat Oregon History episodes are uploaded every weekday morning at around 6 a.m., so it'll be a couple of days before you get your next fix. But of course, Monday morning will be here before we know it. And that's the latest news from here in Offbeat Oregon's Sulphur Springs studio. So now it's time for you and me both to go out there and fill up the rest of the day and the weekend with good stuff. Bye now.